And there was another big story in the news this week, the NFL's multi-million-dollar settlement with former players and their families over concussions. The NFL agreed to a $765 million settlement, and it could have repercussions for the way the game is played from peewee leagues on up. In college football, the NCAA is reportedly trying to negotiate a settlement to a similar lawsuit over concussions suffered by college athletes. But injuries are not the only challenge facing the college game. For players and fans, there is a growing gap between passion and profits. And that's the subject of John Bacon's new book, Fourth and Long, The Fight for the Soul of College Football. John, is there really any difference at this point between the NFL and college football?
It's getting closer and closer, and that to me is the problem, because you don't watch college football due to the excellence. The Detroit Lions, who have traditionally been horrible, can always beat the Michigan Wolverines, even at their very best. We watch college football the same way we watch the Little League World Series, and a million people watch that this week, because it's the passion, the identity, the energy these players bring, the very unique, I think, relationship between the players and the fans, which is the closest you will find in sports. And these teams don't change their colors. They don't threaten to move to Nashville for a new stadium. The players don't go on strike, they don't get locked out, and they don't get traded. They actually choose their teams, whereas the NFL literally drafts you. So there are still very important differences, but you're very right that the gap between these two things, one used to be for the students by the students, one was built by moneymakers for moneymakers. Man, it is getting harder and harder to tell them apart.
Well, your book deals with the Big Ten Conference teams, Penn State, Ohio State, Michigan, and Northwestern. Why did you select those teams? What do they tell us about what's going on in college football now?
They're not just the canaries in the coal mine. They are actually the coal miners. Because my feeling is if the Big Ten cannot compete nationally while caring more about academics and ranked higher than SEC schools, and caring more about football than the Ivy League, if the Big Ten can't do it, then you're pretty much down to a minor league. And the reason I picked Michigan, Ohio State, and Penn State is they're three of the seven most successful programs historically. They have the three biggest stadiums, the three biggest fan bases. The fan bases of Michigan, Ohio State, and Penn State are bigger than every other conference out there in total. So those three are pretty easy, and all three in the last 2 years have had NCAA probation of some sort or other and had to fire their coach. So how those transitions work becomes fascinating. At Penn State, I looked at the players. I got complete access there. At Ohio State, I looked at Urban Meyer, one of the biggest coaches, two or three in the country. At Michigan, I looked at the athletic director, Dave Brannon, who's been on 60 Minutes and is by far the most visible AD in the country. Then Northwestern, which, as you know, is a bit of an exception to a lot of these things.
Yeah.
But there I could look at I talked to Morton Shapiro, the president, all the way down to Kane Coulter, the quarterback, who also happens to be a pre-med student. And good luck with that, by the way, with your 40 hours a week of football. And that's where you kind of see the whole thing come together in what I think is probably the purest form, and that was probably the feel-good part of the book.
Yeah, well, you spoke with Jack Griffin in the Northwestern Development Office, and you asked the question, what would Northwestern be like today if it had left the Big Ten during the dark decades? He says, without Big Ten football, we'd be a top-notch research institution. What's wrong with that?
Nothing's wrong with that, of course. And right down the road, of course, down Lakeshore Drive, you have the University of Chicago, which was in the Big Ten. People don't realize this, a founding member. The first employee they hired was the president. The second employee they hired in 1892 was Amos Alonzo Stagg, who was the winningest coach in college football for many years. Chicago did discover, and I've got five pages on Chicago in this book, amazingly, that, okay, you don't need big-time football, but you better have something. They used to let in 71% of all students that applied 20 years ago. In other words, if you were smart, I mean, almost everybody got in. Then they added theater, better dorms, better food, and now it's down to 9% admissions rate, right up there with Harvard, Yale, and Princeton. But you have to offer something. So if you're going to be in the Big Ten, you better at least be competitive, or else make fancier dorms and better food. In Northwestern's case, they did try to beef up football. It has worked. And now they're getting about 80% capacity in their stadium. It's a rallying point for their fans. And as Pat Fitzgerald pointed out, the head coach, if these students here don't have a good time while they're in school, 20 years from now, they're not writing you a check. So we are building alumni relations when they're 19 and 20. And I have to tell you, one of the great feel-good parts of the book is hanging out in the end zone of Northwestern where kids still run wild It's about $5-6 to get in usually. It's a great family atmosphere, and that is leaving the other three schools because it's too expensive.
At the same time, you hear about growth like that, and you think, well, this is exactly the problem. It's getting successful. It's going to have a lot of money involved, and you're going to have exactly the same problems that you're having in other programs around the country.
One line I've got in the book is Northwestern is getting better, and that is kind of the scary part. Once you put one foot on the treadmill, sooner or later you're running with the big boys. The question in this book is, can you compete with the big boys without really becoming one of the big boys? And that's their challenge so far, but they are doing a wonderful job at Northwestern.
There has been a lot said about what happened at Penn State, the Jerry Sandusky sex abuse scandal, then the firing of the longtime coach Joe Paterno. What did you learn in looking into that that we didn't already know?
A couple things. One, obviously, that Joe Paterno built Penn State football, but I also learned he also built Penn State University. It was his driving force, and he called out the trustees at a big meeting in 1983 to build a better library, and he added his own money.
He says we got to get some better teachers.
Exactly. Get better teachers, and you get better students, and we'll start with a better library. And nobody raised more money for that school than Joe Paterno did, the whole school, not just football. So he ended up being more powerful than the president himself, who 10 years ago asked for his resignation at Joe's kitchen table. He did not get his resignation. He walked out with his tail between his legs. So at that point, you know who's running the show. What you didn't know before, perhaps, is that the players themselves, who loved him and respected him, by the last few years of Joe's career, he was really barely coaching at all. He did not know the players' names. He did not go to coaches' meetings. He did not call the plays. The players felt on some level it was a bait and switch. We came here for Joe, and we're being coached by everybody else.
We're talking with John Bacon. His new book is Fourth and Long, The Fight for the Soul of College Football. We've got an excerpt at hereandnow.org, and we'll have more with him after a break.
While we wait, Secretary of State John Kerry, he's expected this hour to lay out U.S. policy going forward in Syria. In Damascus, shops are filled with people stocking up on bread and other things. Obviously, people waiting to hear there as well. But we'll take a break. More with Jeremy's conversation here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from GEICO, protecting drivers and their families with insurance coverage for over 75 years. More at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO.
Let's return to our conversation about college football. The season kicked off last night, and one of the games featured a 75-yard game-winning touchdown by Mississippi's Jeff Scott in the Rebels game against Vanderbilt. Here's how it sounded on ESPN.
And look at Scott, the cutback move, and then it's a foot race, and he's going to win the foot race. And Mississippi takes the lead 39-35 with just a minute and change to go.
Well, we're talking with John Bacon. His book is called Fourth and Long, The Fight for the Soul of College Football. It's about the gap between the passion and of the players and the fans and the huge profits college football generates. And John, there are some stunning figures in this book. You write, head football coaches at Division I public universities now average more than $2 million a year, an increase of 750% adjusted for inflation since 1984, which is about 20 times more than professor salaries increased over the same period. Who is to blame for that?
All of us, ultimately, but you got to put it, at the end of the day, on the presidents and the trustees of these universities. These schools have always had a tug of war with big-time sports, you know, the money versus the passion versus the academics. This car used to have gas pedal and brakes, and they used to fight each other. The brakes have been cut. It's all gas pedal now because the faculties are no longer part of these boards. That's a big mistake. The presidents have been cowed by the athletic directors. The money has gotten way too much. And whenever these coaches rationalize their salaries, they always talk about return on investment and market value and so on. Hey, man, this is a nonprofit. These are state universities. Albert Einstein was a professor at Princeton. I doubt he got market value. I doubt he got his return of investment returned to him. That's not how it's supposed to work in a state university. So I've got a big problem with that. And great line from Percy Bates, the former faculty rep at the University of Michigan. He said, you know, everyone always says, well, if we don't pay them $5 million, someone else is going to.
Yeah.
And his line is, let them. There are a lot of good coaches out there. Let them pay him $5 million. So, and, you know, 50 years ago, 40 years ago, Bo Schembechler at Michigan was making $21,000. If you play for him, you're probably going to do better than he is when you graduate. And you know this. Now when the coaches are making $3, $4, $5 million and the players can't even afford a $300 junker to get around campus, it starts looking worse and worse. And after a while, the appearances and the gap become untenable.
But a lot of this came up when The Atlantic did a big story called The Shame of College Sports back in 2011, and it doesn't seem like anything has changed since then.
You know, and Taylor Branch did a seminal piece of work on that cover story. It was fantastic. Every about 5 years, somebody bangs the drum, the Knight Commission 20 years ago, or this or that. We're all horrified. We all are determined to do something, and nothing ever happens. I think what has to happen is the NCAA has got to be broken down as it now is, because you can't be, again, sheriff and saloon keeper in the same town. It does not work. You need somebody outside to monitor college sports, because these guys can't do it.
And the pressure that gets down to the people who are actually involved in playing the game is amazing. You quote one Ohio State employee saying, "Don't tell anyone this, but I hope we lose just one game. If we go undefeated this year, the pressure next year will be insane."
And be careful what you don't wish for, because he got it. It is already insane there. And this is where, again, the players I love, the fans I love, but the people who really love college football the most have less and less in common with the people who run it. And it's that rope between them, this tug of war, that is about to snap. And it's just getting to be too much. And there's no one there to say, slow down.
I want you to talk about the passion, not the profit, but the passion for college football. You are obviously a guy who loves it more than almost anybody out there. For people who have never been to a college football game, maybe even just specifically never been to a Big Ten college football game, tell us what it's like.
Well, I can tell you this, and of course, Jeremy, you know full well what it's like at Memorial Stadium.
I do, in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois. In fact, I was wondering if you were going to mention the Illini in your book. I guess I should be happy that you didn't.
No way I wasn't going to. Although they make an appearance here. Watch out.
When they lost, usually, right?
I'm afraid so this time around, but basketball's still very good. But, man, the French gave us the cafe, the Irish gave us the pub, the Japanese gave us the karaoke bar. The Big Ten has given us tailgating, and I've been to 35 countries on 6 continents. If there's a better place to be on a fall Saturday than a Big Ten tailgate, I have not seen it. It's the sense that we're all here together, this generosity, man. Anybody will give you a bratwurst and a beer just for showing up. And the generosity with the players, everyone's doing this for irrational reasons, and the problem is our love for this is so irrational that that's where the moneymakers have got us. The players will put up with a lot more than they should, and the fans pay for a lot more than they should. And that's where I think this rope is really nearing a breaking point.
But people are willing to pay you, right? It costs, what, $1,000 for a weekend of college football these days?
It's something like that. For a family of four at Michigan, it's about $500 just for the tickets and parking.
Wow.
Disney World, Jeremy, costs less than that, and Mickey never loses.
That's true.
It never snows in Orlando, man. I guarantee you that. We are starting to pay for it, but look at Penn State. They've lost, thanks to overpricing, they've lost 3,000 season ticket holders in 2010, 3,000 more in 2011, and 3,000 more in 2012. And two of those three seasons, pretty much, are before Sandusky breaks. Penn State fans are the most loyal fans out there. They will drive an average of 4 hours for those games. And think about that. If they're starting to get turned off by the price, we have reached a threshold, a saturation point. And again, this is canaries in the coal mine. The people who are running college football had better take notice of what's starting to happen now.
But as you write, the money is there. $5.6 billion over 12 years just for the TV rights is something that's on the line right now. Do you think the passion can win out over the profits?
It can if they stand up. Right now, the profits are winning in a landslide, this tug of war. The profits are just dragging the passion through the mud here. It's not even a contest. But look, one of these days, one of two things is going to happen. As I say in the book, one of these days, one of the coaches said, the player's going to run across the tunnel, sit down, and refuse to play. That's going to happen one of these days, and I don't know what's stopping them, really. And second thing is, the fans will finally say, enough. I can mow my lawn. I can do some gardening. I can take my kid to soccer practice or do something else. Sooner or later, alternatives are going to be found. And if they don't watch this, that's when $5.6 billion all of a sudden looks pretty shaky if the fans aren't there.
And, John, we've been talking all about money in college football. Now we're moving toward a real playoff in college football, which seems to be all about money.
You know, the playoffs, the league championship series, the conference realignments, all this stuff is driven by one thing and one thing only. It's money. They never ask the fans. They never ask the players. And as far as the conferences go, it's like the British chopping up the Middle East in the 1920s without knowing the difference between Sunnis, Shiites, and Kurds. I don't know why Maryland Rutgers are in the Big Ten, except for money. For a while, Boise State, Tulsa, and San Diego State were flirting with the Big East. I don't know about your map, but the East cannot be that big. It is. No one's asking for this but the moneymakers.
John Bacon's new book is called Fourth and Long, The Fight for the Soul of College Football. John Bacon, thank you so much for joining us.
Jeremy, thank you.
And if you have just joined us, our top story today, Secretary of State John Kerry expected to speak in a few minutes about the U.S. response to Syria. We will carry that statement live when it happens. The president has been meeting with his senior national security advisors to talk about plans for a possible military strike. Various military leaders have been seen going in and out of the White House. The president says Syrian President Bashar al-Assad was behind the chemical weapons attack in Syria last week, and he has evidence to prove that. But we just heard a top retired general say, yes, but what is endgame? Perhaps we'll hear that in a few minutes from Secretary Kerry. You're listening to Here and Now.